And now, back to Brainstorming with Billy.
The Living Brain.
Now, here's your host, Billy the Brain.
Welcome back. This is Bill Frank, and you're listening to Brainstorming with Billy the Brain here on KKZZ, Positive Talk Radio for Ventura and Santa Barbara counties. Every show has a theme, but before we get to today's theme, I do want to announce the results of this week's poll. I asked a simple multiple-choice question. Who had a greater influence on U.S. history? Was it Martin Luther King or Cesar Chavez? By an overwhelming majority, 92% to 8%, voters said that it was Martin Luther King who had the greater influence on U.S. history. Look for a new poll to go up on my website, brainstormingonline.com, starting tomorrow. I'll announce it on the air, and then we'll announce the winners on next Thursday's show. Every show has a theme, and today's theme is unintended consequences. Each of my guests is discussing the unintended results of their particular subject. My next guest is a law professor, a public interest lawyer, and a mystery novelist. We'll discuss how individual rights are being violated by social networks and the web, and the need for a constitution of the internet from her book, I Know Who You Are, I Saw What You Did. And if you have a question, or if you want to join in the conversation, you can call us at 639-0008. Laurie Andrews is a law professor and a public interest lawyer and a mystery novelist, as I said. She's taught at Princeton. She's written for television legal dramas, and she's advised governments around the world about emerging technologies. Now she's focusing on how social networks are changing our lives for good and for bad. Laurie started her consumer activism when she was 7 years old and her Ken doll went bald. She sent a letter to Mattel, got some action, and she's been fighting for people's rights ever since then. She's a professor at of law at Chicago Kent College of Law. Laurie frequently appears on television, including Oprah, 60 Minutes, Good Morning America, and Nightline. The American Bar Association dubbed her a lawyer with a literary bent who has the scientific chops to rival any CSI investigator. She received her BA summa cum laude from Yale College and her JD from Yale Law School. She's a fellow at the Hastings Center, joining us from the Midwest. Hi, Laurie. How are you today?
I'm doing great and happy to be here.
Well, thank you so much for being our guest. This is a very interesting subject, and I'm glad to have a subject matter expert like yourself on the air. So let's dive right into it. Programs like Facebook, Foursquare, Twitter, and other internet applications are definitely eroding our privacy. Anybody can trace your quote-unquote digital trail to determine a great deal about you, what you like, what you don't like, who you're affiliated with, and so forth. But here's the thing. It should be remembered that people are giving up this information voluntarily. No one puts a gun to their head and said, post on Facebook. So why should we be concerned about the activity that people knowingly and willingly participate in on the internet?
Well, this ties into your theme of unintended consequences. So you post a picture of yourself with a wine glass in your hand at a friend's wedding. You think that's innocent enough, but 35% of employers say that they won't hire someone because they have a drink in their hand on Facebook, and it's a perfectly legal activity. You just don't know what the consequences are. Or in one case, a woman was injured in a workplace accident. She had four surgeries. She had to have pins put into her spine, but when she sued, the judge actually said, oh, your MySpace photo shows that you're smiling. You couldn't have been hurt. The judge didn't even ask, was that picture taken before the injury? And so you find that you can't guard yourself because things that seem innocent might be used against you.
Well, it should be noted, Lori, that that product liability lawsuit that you just referenced, that was back in New York, and they have a whole different justice system back there. But you've got some other great examples.
I'm bringing you to California, though, because you've talked about voluntarily giving up information. Well, in California, a data aggregation company called Nebuad actually made deals with people's internet service providers, and behind the users' backs put hardware at the internet service provider that copied every email you sent, every posting you did on a social network, every Google search, and sold that to advertisers. Now, I didn't consent to that, and yet federal laws that are supposed to protect me on the internet, like the wiretap statute and the computer fraud statute, actually have exceptions, and they say if the internet service provider consents, or the website consents, then that website or internet service provider can sell your personal information, your movement on the web, without you even being told or given a chance to opt out.
Now, that is a disturbing thing. My guest is Lori Andrews, author of the book, I Know Who You Are and I Saw What You Did, Social Networks and the Death of Privacy. And let's talk about the federal laws, in particular the wiretap law that you just referenced in that last answer. And in the light, or I guess in the fight against terrorism, a lot of our civil liberties are being abused. The greatest purchaser of internet information data right now is the U.S. government, and they are scrubbing this information looking for terms such as terrorist, plot, bomb, certain things, in an effort to thwart the next great terror attack that might be coming our way. So when the government is actively participating this in the pursuit of terrorists, is that a good or a bad thing, and what does that mean overall for our privacy?
Well, our country was set up with a certain set of rules. The U.S. Constitution provides that the government's supposed to get a warrant before they collect information. But you have cops and the IRS searching Facebook pages, and so the Internal Revenue Service will look and say, hey, this guy's got a car that looks a little more than he could afford. Let's do an investigation about his sources of income. And so you're not supposed to have this kind of random search of everybody in the U.S. in order to identify the one person or group of people who might be a terrorist. I mean, think about it. In the old days when the U.S. was formed, the founding fathers could have said, oh, yeah, it's okay if we go into everybody's house and we find something in a drawer that might implicate them in an anti-government plot. But instead, the Constitution said, no, 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 you can't go in a person's house unless you have a reason to suspect that person. Now, it is being done, and it's being done through Homeland Security with some pretty odd search terms. Not bomb, not those sort of things, but they actually, on their list of 350 terms, which I refer to in the book, they include things like if you've written anything with the word vaccine, pork, Guzman, and even the term social media itself. So you're a marketing company, you might have the term social media on your website, and that could get you into trouble. And imagine, poor me, I've written 3 mystery books, so my Google searches are things like, date rape drugs, you know, how to murder someone without it being, detected. This may be my last free chance to talk to you after I'm locked up for my Google searches.
Well, I'm talking to future inmate Lori Andrews about her book, I Know Who You Are, I Know What You Did. Let's go back to this thing about probable cause, Lori, if we can, and drill down on that for a moment. And you mentioned the IRS example where they're trolling the internet looking for people standing next to flashy cars that might be beyond their means. We know that the IRS is tremendously understaffed right now. Are they actively pursuing these random sorts of searches, or is it more a case of where they have probable cause that somebody may be a tax cheat? They will then go in and take a look at their social media streams to figure out whether or not they're living higher than their means would indicate.
Well, I think one thing that's happened in this whole era of social networks, we've moved from being judged as an individual who might be a risk to being judged through aggregate data. And so, I mean, you can easily get a bot, and release it on websites and find out every time someone puts up a term, new car. I mean, you don't need to have individual agents in green eye shades, for example. I mean, even the thieves have found that out. New Hampshire thieves robbed 50 homes by just searching for the word vacation on social network sites. You know, they had a computer that program that did that. Or in Florida, there was a set of thieves that looked on genealogy websites to see who died recently and then filed for income tax refunds under those dead people's names. And it turns out the government had posted, has a list of dead people's social security numbers, so it was easy enough for them to make a killing. And it was only found out because, cops in that area of Florida began to notice there was less street crime. It was more, lucrative to troll with algorithms through computer social network sites and make money that way. So it really isn't triggered by necessarily individualized suspicion, which has really been the way we've done it in the past. I'm also concerned that the right to a fair trial is being turned on its head. You're only supposed to make decisions about evidence that's presented in the courtroom, But now jurors are actually, you know, Googling the witnesses' names or looking at their social media sites to judge whether they're credible or not. And in one case, a juror actually put up the facts of the case on Facebook and asked her friends to vote whether this guy should be convicted or not. So we're seeing that social networks, Google searches, are taking the place of evidence from the courtroom that could, where people could be cross-examined.
Well, now, in which state is that legal to do? Because that's the same as talking to somebody about a trial that you're being impaneled on a jury to do that. That would be against the law in any of our 50 states, wouldn't it?
Yeah, but what's happening is people feel such a right about being on social networks that what's happening is we're having hundreds of mistrials, you know, and of course it's only going to be brought to the judge's attention if one of the jurors tells somebody else, but if they're just doing it and it's not detected. Reuters did a study of tweets, and, you know, there's a tweet from a juror once every 3 minutes, and many of them showed that they were, you know, judging the case before they were even impaneled into the jury. They'd be tweeting things like, he's guilty, I can tell, before they were even seated for the case. So some of it, you're right, existing laws should cover, but I think that judges in the invasion of privacy area aren't giving enough attention to people's privacy in things like Google searches or what they post on social networks.
My guest is Laura Andrews. We're talking about her book, I Know Who You Are, and I Saw What You Did. So you believe that there should be a constitution for the Internet, that all of this is changing so fast that we need to have this new document, the Constitution for the Internet. Why?
I think in part it would serve several purposes. It would remind people who are buying technologies about the ways that technology could be used against them. You'd have to think about, you know, privacy before you bought an iPhone, so that you might disable certain features, like the one that post in a digital form the geographic location where you're taking your picture. So it would help consumers to think about these things. I think it would help courts to have a set of principles that they can judge things by. I mean, it may sound odd. Our Constitution, the U.S. Constitution, does not apply to private individuals, you know, generally, but other countries do have constitutions that apply both to companies and to the government. And right now, I think Facebook, which is, with its 800 million members, is like a country. It has the power and reach of a nation. It has relationships with other countries. It even has its own currency. And yet, it makes certain decisions that affect us all, and we have no recourse.
Well, that is true. If it was a nation by itself, it would be the third largest nation, only behind China and India. But this brings up a bigger issue, and one that I wanted to get to, so I'm glad that you brought it up. And that is, if you have a constitution of the Internet, and let's just say it's a constitution of Facebook. Facebook's 800 million users cross all different countries, all different territories. And the reality is that the Internet is global in and international in its nature. So wouldn't creating a constitution for the Internet supersede the sovereign rights of a lot of nations if you were to implement something like this?
I think one of the things is that the principles I'm talking about are actually widely embraced around the world. And so things like a right to connect, most countries believe that the government shouldn't be able to shut you down just because you're being critical of the government.
Well, but the biggest country in the world, Lori, is China, and the China reserves that right all the time. The China doesn't have the right of free speech. It doesn't have the right to connect, and yet it's a major player in the world today.
Although, when you talk about countries, you talk about things for the people, and if you look at the people of China, they do want the right to connect. I mean, even countries like Estonia have put that now in their constitution. And so I think it taps into what citizens feel, I should say, in democratic countries everywhere. But I'm not suggesting that it be adopted like the Internal Revenue Code. Instead, I think it should be a touchstone to prevent certain things. You and I may disagree about this, but I find it appalling that employers in Maryland and Massachusetts are asking job applicants for their password so they can go into the private side of their Facebook page and you know, see if they go out drinking with friends or things like that.
Well, I would agree that that is appalling. But let's go back to the sovereign nations. I don't want to leave that just for this moment, because it presents a very interesting problem. You say the people in these countries want these rights. That is true. The people in China probably want the right to free speech, the right to connect, many of the rights that you have laid out in your constitution for the internet, a right to a fair trial. So if you throw this up there on the internet, even if it's a touchstone, would this not be something that, say, the Chinese people could then use as a tool, a hammer against their own government to try to get their repressive government to be a little bit more open, a little bit more liberal, maybe even leading into a revolt, an out-and-out revolt?
Well, we certainly saw that in Egypt, where it was YouTube and Twitter and Facebook that allowed people to you know, to gather and protest and move for a more democratic form of government. And that's not unlike the sort of things that were happening at the beginning of this country, except it was pamphlets that were being passed out at the time. And what the U.S. Supreme Court has said is that, hey, the internet just makes handing out pamphlets a lot easier, and it needs to be protected with the same rights to free speech as, as the traditional pamphlets were.
My guest is Lori Andrews, author of the book, I Know Who You Are, I Saw What You Did. So, Lori, what do you want readers to take away from reading your book, I Know Who You Are, I Saw What You Did?
I think the most troubling thing to me is that data aggregators can collect every piece of information about us on the web, and right now we're not protected. And so I'd want people to push for, you know, laws that would make it so that data aggregators cannot get my personal information unless I've agreed in advance.
And that is a very worthwhile goal. My guest has been Lori Andrews. Lori, this is a fascinating subject, and it's probably piqued the interest of many of my listeners that are out there. If they want to learn more about you, learn more about the book, where would you direct them to go on the internet?
Socialnetworkconstitution.com. They can actually vote on the Social Network Constitution, and it may convince me to change it in some of the ways you're suggesting.
All right. Well, hopefully we've shed some new light on that for you, and it's certainly a worthwhile discussion. We'll have you back in the future to talk about how the Constitution is progressing. Lori, thank you so much for being my special guest. We'll talk to you down the road.
Okay, my pleasure.
Thanks.